This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We are 24 days, Rick, away from the 2023 NFL Draft. This is With the First Pick, the CBS Sports NFL Draft Podcast. This is episode 32. I'm Ryan Wilson. That's Rick, our general manager, Mr. Spielman. More than 30 years of NFL experience, including a decade as the Vikings general manager. Today, we're talking just good football players, version 4.0. We'll answer a couple mailbag questions after that. Please keep those coming. But first, Rick, we got a very special guest, and this is the first time we've had a guest on this podcast from outside the CBS Sports family, so this is pretty exciting. But first, just a quick reminder that Rick and I concluded our With the First Pick Pro Day trip last week when we did an immediate reaction pod from Gainesville, Florida, right after Anthony Richardson put on a show. So check that out in the old podcast feed, along with our Pro Day pods from Ohio State, Alabama, and Kentucky the week before that. And this week on Wednesday, we'll be talking about the tight ends and offensive linemen in this draft class with even more special guests on Wednesday. So look out for that. And all, as always, you can watch us live on YouTube at NFL on CBS. Be sure to subscribe and leave a comment. And hey, drop us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, if you like the show, tell a friend. All right, let's get to it. Rick, we have with us today.
How many like shows before I can do that? Or are you going to be the one that has to do that all the time?
You're more than welcome to do it. And in fact, you're going to be driving this ship a little bit today because we have a very special guest in Eric Sugarman, longtime coworker with Rick Spielman in Minnesota. I think you guys both arrived in 2006 and you guys worked together through 2022. And you were not only the head trainer, like specifically. Let's see. What was your time?
Hey, can we cut to the chase so you can stop reading? All right. I gave him all kinds of titles and promotions. And
okay. Yeah. You tell us
everything.
So tell us.
He came in as the head athletic trainer. On a serious note, though, the best I've ever been around in the business.
All right.
He was elevated up to vice president of overseeing all of our medical, our sports science, our team psychology team. So he did a lot. And one of the best in the business, and hopefully he won't be doing his podcast much longer. He'll be with another NFL club shortly. He also consulted with the NFL league office this year, working with Jeff Miller, Dr. Sills, and all the medical team right out of the NFL office in New York. So highly regarded, not only by the league office, but highly regarded in the league itself and by many people. Shug, didn't you get a award for best ankle taper of the year award 1 year?
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the great introduction, Rick. I knew it had to end with something silly, but I'm glad you still think athletic trainers are just ankle tapers, but I really appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast and look forward to having this conversation.
Yeah, so head athletic trainer, director of sports medicine. I think that was one of your titles. I don't know if that was the last title that Rick gave you, but that's what I was looking for earlier. And Rick, you've known Eric forever. I met him at the combine, and I love Eric not even knowing what he did because he has a bunch of stories about you that reminded me of you. And I was glad to know I wasn't the only person that had to endure some of the things that I'd only known you a few months. And Eric, I'll tell you this story quickly. Last week we were in Gainesville, Florida. And I only tell you this because you've told me some basketball stories about Rick and how competitive he is. Rick, I'll start the story and then you can finish it. We were staying at the hotel, and downstairs they had a pool table, and Rick and I went to dinner. We came back. It was like 7:30 at night because, you know, Rick goes to bed pretty early. And Rick, we played three games of pool. Do you want to explain to Eric how things turned out?
Yeah, I went 0-3 because I've been sitting there studying tape and actually watching players while some people, you know, at 5 o'clock, they go to the pool hall in Syracuse, New York, and make a little money on the side. So I got hustled, you know, and I've got hustled before by Shug on the golf course. It's
I was going to say, 0-3 sounds very familiar to the golf we played at Sanibel Island, Rick. So you're used to that. I guess you're just in a slump when it comes to competitive sports.
Although I shot an 88 this morning, so I'm back
in. Oh, you did? Okay, you're back in it. You're back in. Yeah. I haven't seen Rick play. You play with him, Eric, but he said four of the last five rounds he shot in the 80s, I believe. The one bad round came after you got stuck in Atlanta late night when we returned from one of the pro days. So you're back in form, Rick?
Yeah, I'm back in form, and I just have to tell you, Shug is probably the best circus athlete I've ever been around. So if you need to hire him to win your girlfriend a teddy bear and he'll throw those ping pong balls in a fishbowl, you'll have him do anything at a circus, because he is the best circus athlete I've ever been around. Although,
thank you.
I have to recognize you. He actually came down to Sanibel last summer, introduced him to pickleball. Me and my brother took on him, and I believe was it Jake or was it Ben?
It was Jake,
and the Spielmans came out on top, and then he went on, because he's very competitive as well, went on back to Minnesota and done multiple pickleball tournaments, has won a couple of them, but the Spielman brothers will be 1-0 forever in the history of our pickleball tournaments, and I will go with that victory to my grave.
So are you saying you're not going to play Eric ever again?
No, never again.
It'd be terrible. It would be so bad. Him and his brother are two of the stiffest athletes you've ever seen in your life. It's embarrassing. And the only reason we didn't win is because I didn't know the rules. So that was it.
Oh, that's your trick, Rick. You get people to play games that they don't know what they are, and then you beat them.
Oh, just read it. It's in a book. Read it before you play.
Eric, dude, I am so happy to have you on this podcast. I know Rick wanted to have you on too, because you have a wealth of experience, and Rick gave you the really great introduction here. So let's just jump right in, because let's start with concussion protocol, because I would imagine, and I was looking at your resume here, and I mentioned to our guy Billy, who's producing today, that you were with the Eagles from 2000 to 2005. You said you were there for all four NFC Championship games. Before that, you spent some time with the Bears. And then you landed in 2006 in Minnesota when Mr. Spielman arrived. But I have a specific question, but I want to ask generally, how much has the concussion protocol changed from the 90s till today? Because it feels like even the last 4 or 5 years, there have been huge changes. I would imagine in the 90s when you came into the league, were concussions even taken seriously? Was it a thing where, like, you know, smelling salts? What was the evolution of how the NFL has approached that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're certainly always taken seriously, but, you know, just like, you know, medicine, it's always evolving, and the concussion protocol has done that as well. And, you know, with all of the concussions that happen, they're so widely viewed and so scrutinized in today's game. You know, if you go back to last season with Tua, that was probably, you know, the most famous one last season, and every season you could think of one. So this protocol has been tightened up and not really as a knee-jerk reaction, but more as following the science to try to keep these athletes as safe as possible and keep the great game of football alive and well.
Shug, just to follow up with that, can you explain to everybody the exact protocol that happens on game day when there is a suspected concussion?
Yeah, so, you know, first of all, there's so many eyes on the field at a game, whether it's the medical staff, if you have the team physicians, the athletic trainers, the ATC spotters in the booth, you have what are called UNCs, or unaffiliated neurological consultants that are watching the game, coaches. You know, the one biggest thing I'll say that I saw change in my last few seasons, and really one of the best change, is teammates. Teammates, I would say more often than not, point out concussions to me, if I didn't see it, and if one of their teammates is not acting right, every year there was more and more of their peers coming up to an athletic trainer member, the medical staff, and just saying, "Hey, listen, you better check this guy; he's not right." And that means we're doing something right, because the awareness is working. So, you know, if you'd like me to go through the steps of the protocol, you know, I'm happy to do that. So, obviously at the game, you have to diagnose a concussion or suspect that there's a concussion. That's why we have the, you know, the blue tent, and you go under the blue tent and you do a couple basic questions. It's usually an athletic trainer, a team physician that typically specializes in concussions, and the unaffiliated physician as well. And together you can really relatively quickly decide if that athlete is okay, or if you have any suspicion that the athlete may be concussed, you take them directly into the locker room and take them through a battery of tests. At that point, you either decide it's a go or a no-go. Are things that happen on the field that are an automatic no-go that you've heard of? Obviously, a loss of consciousness would be a no-go. They are not allowed back in the game. The fencing posturing that you've seen some athletes do is a no-go. And the one that was added for clarity this season was what's called ataxia, which is a motor dysfunction. So if you have motor loss, if you're slurring your speech or anything like that, that's an automatic no-go. Really amnesia, confusion as well. So any of those things, players out for the game, they enter the protocol and go through these five steps, which I'll go through for you quickly. The first step, phase one, you know, usually the day after the game, you're evaluating the athlete with a team physician. They do rather quickly now see what's the INC, which is an independent neurological consultant. The athletes see the independent doctor while they're symptomatic, typically in day one or day two after the injury. So in phase one, the athlete's at what's, you know, called relative rest. Now, back in the day, we would put concussed athletes in a dark room and just tell them to not have any stimulation. And we found through science that that's probably not the best treatment. You know, a little bit of activity, a little bit of brain stimulation is usually good as long as they could tolerate it. So we, you know, we would let them just maybe move their legs on an exercise bike or something like that. We would not let them go to meetings or look at film, try to have them stay off their phone, off the video games during phase one. And they're still symptomatic. And as long as they're symptomatic, they stay in phase one. That could be one day, could be 5 days or longer. Once they don't have any symptoms anymore, then they enter phase two, and it's a five-phase return to play protocol. So phase two now, again, their symptoms are gone, and now they can start doing aerobic activity. So, you know, we put them on the bike, elliptical, jog, whatever it might be, get their heart rate up, get a little sweat going, and have some aerobic activity. Again, they're not allowed to practice at this point. They're just kind of getting back, and if at any point they get any symptoms, they stop and they revert back to the previous phase. And you have to be able to accomplish each phase without any return of symptoms or any exacerbation of symptoms while you do this. So that would be phase two. While they're in phase two, we do let them go to meetings. We let them start looking at film and do that kind of stuff, because a lot of these concussions go through your eyes. And sometimes just watching film in a meeting room will make them have symptoms, and we'll have to pause. So that's always a very good test. Phase three is football related activities. So not necessarily a full practice. They are allowed to practice non-contact for up to 30 minutes. Usually that would be like an individual period. They can do the walkthrough stuff typically in phase three, but now they do football related activities. So whatever you deem that, if it's a lineman, you know, have them get in a stance and come out and just do what they do in their job. They can lift weights. In phase three, they could get in the weight room and stress themselves with some resistance training, which is also another thing that sometimes triggers symptoms. So very important that they can follow that phase and not return to symptoms. They at this point also do the neurological testing, neurocognitive testing. I'm sorry. So whether it's the impact test, each team has a neuropsychologist. They do what we call pencil and paper testing, where they take them through some questions with pencil and paper and to make sure that they're at their baseline. Of course, every player has a baseline that's taken before the season, so you can compare apples to apples and understand if a player has returned to their baseline with this testing. They accomplish all this, they get into phase four, which is a non-contact practice. We would put a red jersey on a guy, make sure that they can not have any contact in practice. They can do everything with normal, just no head to head, no contact, and try to keep them off the ground, obviously, in phase four. And along all these steps of the journey. They're meeting with the athletic trainers, they're meeting with the team physicians, and they're getting cleared for each phase. Once they accomplish phase four, they go into phase five, which is just a normal full contact practice. Once they can accomplish this without any problems, they're cleared by the team physician for return to game. And once that team physician makes that determination, they then see the independent neurological consultant a final time for full clearance. And the team physician and the independent physician agree that this athlete is able to return back to the game.
So, Eric, you mentioned teammates doing a better job. An example of that was last year in the Patriots game on the field. Nelson Aguilar made them stop the game because Devontae Parker looked concussed and they brought him off. And I think he was eventually diagnosed. And historically, we heard Richard Sherman talk about this early in his career, that he knew he had a concussion. He wasn't telling anyone because he was a day three pick and he was trying to earn a job out there. So there were reasons for secrecy. And you also mentioned the Tua thing last year, because that felt like a turning point. Even though we've come pretty far in terms of taking these head injuries, seriously, you mentioned ataxia, and even though Tua appeared to display that, he was cleared to go back in. I don't think Mike McDaniel, the head coach or the medical staff had any ill intentions by sending him back out there. I think he probably passed everything, and they later said that he had like back issues that perhaps had something to do with the ataxia that we saw initially in that week three concussion against Buffalo. I don't know if you were watching the game at the time or if you saw the stuff later where he seemed to stumble. I would imagine that would get on your attention, get on your radar. Was there something that went wrong that could have gone better there? Because the NFL and the NFLPA did their investigation and said the Dolphins did everything by the book. And we know later that the rules changed in terms of the concussion protocol. But people seeing it felt like there was something wrong with Tua, but medically he was clear to go back in.
Yeah, that, you know, Ryan, that's the hard part. You know, these injuries happen all the time, high school, college, you know, whatever it might be. In the NFL, when anything happens, there's 15 cameras at every game.
Right.
And there's so much scrutiny on everything that happens. And you know, the NFL and the NFLPA did their investigation, that and the Miami Dolphins were not at fault. They were proven not at fault. Everyone did their job the way they were supposed to. And listen, it's tough. It's a tough job. And to take any ambiguity out of it, they added the ataxia rule because the Madden rule is when in doubt, keep them out. And that just helps. So there is no ambiguity. And you know what? If you hold the guy out of the game when maybe you shouldn't have or you didn't have to, it is so much better when we're talking about someone's brain to err on the side of caution. So I give credit to those guys in Miami for, you know, having to go through what they had to go through publicly when they did their job the right way.
Shug, just moving on to another subject here. There was a new medical summit this past week at the owners' meetings. Can you tell everybody a little bit what that was about?
Yeah, that was new, Rick. So, you know, all of the athletic trainers typically would meet at Indianapolis at the Combine. I think we're going to talk about the Combine here in a little while, but the athletic trainers would all gather at the Combine, but because the Combine has changed a little bit, only two athletic trainers from each club attended the Combine in Indy. There was no ability for all of the clubs to meet together. And it's really a crucial time in the off season because there's so much information. We talk about things like protocol changes with the concussions. We talk about all of the different protocols across the league, all of the different research projects that are going on and different business with the group that's called PFATS, the Professional Football Athletic Trainer Society. And because that wasn't able to happen in Indy, they had the first annual, and it will be an annual medical summit. And this was great. I was able to attend as part of the NFL Health and Safety Group, as well as part of being a PFATS alumni. And really just a great idea. Many great speakers. They had 3 days of meetings. They had a big award show, but 3 days of meetings where it was educational. The NFL presented, Dr. Sills, you know, Megan Carroll, all of those types of people presented to the athletic trainers to keep them up to date with what's going on. And then education, 2 days of education where there was courses like dry needling and things like that to help athletic trainers stay current to help their players. So really see this summit as something that was is going to build and build and become bigger. And, you know, maybe one day the strength coaches will be there in their meetings and the dietitians will be in their meetings and everyone can bring it together in what's, you know, becoming the medical model and all these different practitioners that get together to help these players.
Yeah, you talked about all the cameras on the field and all the things that everyone does to stay up to date. And I think it just is reinforced by the fact of how everything went off pretty much flawlessly when DeMar Hamlin had his on-field situation, because you go back and read the accounts of all the medical folks that are there, the people that got to him first and made sure they kept him in the best possible situation until the ambulance could get him to the hospital and all the things. It could have been a 200-step process. It felt like all those 200 steps were met within the time frame that needed to happen to make sure that that he survived. And I think that's important to remember, because it is frustrating when you see a player get hurt and you think that perhaps things aren't following protocol, when in reality there's just 4,000 different variables that have to happen. And I think it's important to reinforce that this happens all year long. We know what the players do in terms of the pre-draft process and the Senior Bowl and the Shrine Bowl and the Combine and the Pro Days, because that's televised. All this other stuff behind the scenes isn't televised. And before we move on, I have a question from the Peanut Gallery. I mean, producer Billy. And I mentioned Eric, he's a Eagles fan. And he had a question for, how in the world did Terrell Owens play after he broke his ankle in that Super Bowl? I had to look it up quickly. So he broke his ankle 7 weeks before. Rick, do you remember who broke his ankle?
No, I do not.
I think it was Roy Williams with the horse collar tackle. Is that right?
It was.
And then they had to ban that tackle because that was the only way that Roy Williams would tackle people, because he was so slow. Hopefully Roy Williams doesn't listen to this podcast, but that's the truth. But so 7 weeks, he broke his ankle. He tore a ligament in his ankle, and he showed up in the Super Bowl, and he played 62 of 72 snaps. He caught 9 passes for 122 yards in a game that T.O. single-handedly tried to drag the Eagles to that Super Bowl victory. Can you give us any insight into what happened over those 7 weeks where he went from broken leg, I think it was high ankle sprain maybe, to playing in the Super Bowl?
Yeah, I mean, incredible. You know, T.O. I think gets a bad rap. I think he's an incredible person. And I had the pleasure of being part of the medical team to help him get better for that Super Bowl. I can't take credit. Rick Burkholder, the current head athletic trainer for the Kansas City Chiefs, was the head athletic trainer for the Philadelphia Eagles and one of my best friends in the world. And, you know, he allowed me to do some of the rehab with T.O. And it was remarkable. You know, along your career, 25 seasons in the NFL, I've been really fortunate to have a few what I call genetic freaks. Terrell Owens was one, Brian Dawkins was one, Adrian Peterson was one, and I could go on and on, but these guys are just different. And T.O. was bent on playing in that Super Bowl, and I remember, I mean, I could talk about it and the podcast would be over, but I'd give the quick summary is I do remember how hard that kid worked.
Take your time. This is great.
Oh, he'll go on forever. Go ahead, Joe. Give a quick summary. I got 25 more questions to get through in 10 minutes.
Stop it.
I have to give him credit for, it's one of the first times I've ever seen someone work that hard at rehab, just day and night to get better and to be determined to do it. And it was very chaotic as we got to the Super Bowl. You know, the physician that operated on did not want to clear him. He made him sign a waiver. And ultimately, you know, T.O. at practice on Wednesday, we were in Jacksonville, Florida at Sawgrass, another golf course I beat Rick on. He looked terrible on Wednesday. And
Rick,
I remember Rick
T.O.
telling me, well, no, Rick wasn't there, thank God. But T.O. looked terrible. I remember Rick, the head athletic trainer, Rick Burkholder, you know, saying Andy Reid said, just forget it. Like, this guy, there's no chance. He looks terrible. And everyone begged Andy, give him a chance. Well, you know, try to get him out there Thursday. And he went out there Thursday, looked a little bit better, still not great. And no one, you would say, yeah, he's going to be ready to go. And then Friday, you know, even better. And Saturday, even better. And if we would have been fortunate enough to win that game, T.O. would have been the MVP of the Super Bowl by far. And just a remarkable effort by him. And I remember they took the screw out of his ankle. They thought the screw was going to snap, which was one of the possible complications. They thought it would snap, and it didn't. They took the screw out. It was perfectly straight, and he had a necklace made out of it. So I'm sure he still has it. But what a great guy, and what a great effort. One of the first best efforts I've ever seen an athlete make to be determined to play in a game that he really wanted to play in.
Rick, that's a guy that's going to play in a bowl game no matter what.
Yeah, no, throw the ball out there, see if they'll go out and compete. That one will compete, as will Adrian compete. Yeah. Hey, yeah, Shug, I just want to touch quickly, too, on we talked about how important the concussion protocol is now and player health and safety, but we don't talk enough about the mental health and how that protocol has been put in place and how big an impact that has had on teams in the NFL.
Yeah, I agree, Rick. You know, there's a mental health and wellness committee that was established years ago, and from that came a lot of changes in rules. You know, players get constant education on mental health, and a couple seasons back, the NFL and the health and safety group mandated that each team designates a single mental health clinician, and that individual must be in the building for a minimum of 8 hours a week. And most teams, it's a lot more than that. And that's for many reasons. It's for availability. It's for visibility. It's for comfort, so that the player sees this physician around. I can't emphasize enough the mental health, the stuff that I've seen through my years. You know, everyone that watches the NFL games on Sunday sees these big, tough NFL gritty football players. But you have to understand on the other days of the week, on Monday through Saturday, these guys are people like you and I and people that listen to your podcast. They have life issues, whether it's stuff with their spouse or their friends or their parents or themselves. And these big tough guys, they need help too. And you know, I think that's what's changing is they're asking for help, some of these guys. And it's just more and more aware every year. The education is forced on these guys so that they understand it is okay to ask for help. And you know, another thing that gets overlooked, Rick, is the guys that get placed on injured reserve. You know, you can be a star player, get placed on injured reserve, and maybe you'll travel with the sideline. But if you're a fringe player and you get placed on injured reserve, you know, I'm not going to say you're ostracized, because you're not, because you're in the training room every day. You're doing your rehab. Sometimes you're going to meetings, but it's really tough because you don't really feel like you're contributing. And these are the guys that you have to also attack and make sure that their mental health is okay. So I can't emphasize enough for anyone listening to the podcast. If you're having an issue, you need help, just say something. That's how you could be tough.
You know, one of the things that I just wanted to follow up, Ryan, on this mental health stuff is that we really try to put a point of emphasis on that it's not a sign of weakness if you reach out and ask for help, because everybody thinks, well, you're a tough NFL player, you have this persona about you. But like Shug said, they're people too, and they have real problems just like all of us have real problems. But everybody sees them, well, if you go see the psychologist or you go ask for help, that's a sign of weakness, that you're not big and tough on the field. But it's the exact opposite. And what we try to implement is to make sure, even like we talked about teammates talking about, hey, I think this guy is not right, he may have a concussion. It's the same thing on a mental health side, that if someone sees something that's not right, don't be afraid to speak up, because mental health is a huge issue and it's getting put to the forefront now. In the past, it would always be, hey, don't say anything about you're going to see this psychologist or you're going to go get this help, because they're going to think you're weak. But in essence, we try to put it in the forefront of everything and show that it's a sign of strength, that if you are struggling, whether you're on an NFL team, whether you're on this podcast, I go see mental help every time after I get off with Ryan just to get through it. But I'm ready to go the next podcast. But on a serious note, it's very important to recognize that if you or a family member is having issues, to make sure you go out and seek the help, because it's not a sign of weakness. To me, it's a sign of strength.
Yeah. And that's it. That's important. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah. Sorry. The other thing, Ryan, sorry to interrupt, is in the NFL also, you know, sometimes players just, they don't want to see the guy or the gal that's in the building, because they don't want someone seeing them talking to them. So, you know, we always made sure there was a confidential way for them to see someone outside of the building as well. And the NFL offers what's called the NFL Lifeline, which is a 24/7 phone number that it's free to any member of the NFL, alumni, or the family. They could get help. So it's just critical. And something like Rick just said, if you see something, then say something.
Yeah. And the thing is, look, I graduated from college in 1995. And don't ask me how many times it took me to graduate, Rip, because I'm not answering the question. But one of my best friends to this day was on the golf team at William & Mary, which is a mid-level Division I program. And he went and saw the sports psychologist. I remember in 1993, we gave him a hard time about it, just made him, just called him soft and said he was being too weak and all the other stuff. Fast forward 25, 30 years, however long, almost 30 years now. And I cannot recommend therapists, whatever you need, enough. And we've heard guys like Marshawn Lynch say it. Check your mentals, and he's not joking. Hayden Hurst has come out. Dak Prescott has come out. And I think that's incredibly important. And I think it was brought home again, not to bring it back to DeMar Hamlin, but there were a lot of people struggling with how to deal with that because a young man almost died in the middle of a football field in a game. And the teammates that were close by, teammates that knew him from Pitt, coaches that knew him from Pitt, people that knew him just from around the league, I'm sure there were mental health questions that came up. And to your point, and you guys are both old school grizzled NFL guys, for you to be like, listen, it's okay to do these things, should make it clear that it's okay to do these things. And Rick, for as you know, tough as you come off, you are an incredible softy in terms of taking care of people that you care about. And I know Eric can attest to that. So I'm glad that you got a chance to talk about that. You want to ask the next question, Rick?
Go ahead. All
right. You're transitioning to host, so I was going to give you an opportunity.
Yeah.
But
25 days to the NFL draft.
See, Eric knows what's up. He's been there.
Many times.
Two questions. I'm going to ask you a question that you wanted to discuss. I'm going to ask another question because you mentioned Adrian Peterson. So I'm going off memory here. I think Adrian Peterson tore his ACL like in December, right? It was against December. Washington.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Hey everyone, this is Jimmy Conrad, your favorite former U.S. men's national team player and the host of the Call It What You Want podcast. And I'm here to tell you that Vuori is a versatile clothing brand that speaks my language. It's inspired from the coastal California lifestyle, just like me. Its products stand the test of time, just like me. And also just like me, it endeavors to inspire others to live vibrant, healthy lives. Vuori gear is designed to look great in everyday life while also being perfect for any workout activity. I'm currently rocking the men's Sunday performance jogger, and don't let the name deceive you. You can wear these babies any day of the week and in any situation. I'm talking going to the office, running errands, the gym, whatever your heart desires, because Vuori is an investment in your happiness. For our listeners, they are offering 20% off your first purchase. So get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet at Vuori.com/sports. That's Vuori.com/sports. Not only will you receive 20% off your first purchase, but enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75 and free returns. Again, go to Vuori.com/sports and discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
Yeah, it was New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve.
Okay. Christmas Eve. I'm sorry. December 24th.
There you go. I think it was against Washington, if I recall correctly. And also, if I recall correctly, he was ready to go by September, which is unheard of. You can tell me if I have the dates wrong, but I've torn my ACL. And just so you know, Eric, this is how I introduced myself to Hendon Hooker. I said, Hendon, we have something in common. We both tore our ACLs. And he was incredibly gracious. I'm sure he went back and told people that I was an idiot, but that's okay. Because that is literally the only thing we have in common, Rick, he'll tell you. Rick hates short people. I found out as well. But just tell me how miraculous it is, and you talked about the level of athlete and T.O. and Adrian Peterson, to go from tearing your ACL the night before Christmas, having the surgery, and medicine's changed a lot in terms of how you deal with it, those ACL injuries in the last decade, 12 years, however long it's been, to being ready to go, because you talked about no one worked harder in terms of rehab than T.O., but it doesn't matter when you're having your ACL reconstructed how hard you try to do the physical therapy. You have to wait for your body to make that all whole again. So how remarkable is it that AP was ready to go by the time the season rolled around?
Yeah. And what I said was that at the time, that was the hardest I've seen someone rehab.
Oh, there you go.
But fast forward to Adrian, and that is probably the hardest I've ever seen someone rehab. And again, you know, having my hands on him so much during that rehab, and he spent time with us. He would go to Houston and see his personal trainer, Coop, for a little while, and then he saw another PT there in Houston, and then he'd come back and forth during the off season. But the crux of the rehab was, you know, was with us, and just amazing. And all the milestones along the way, I remember, you know, the day he came back from surgery, he had surgery, I think it was on New Year's Eve. There's a picture of him laying in the bed with all the New Year's hat on and everything, just had surgery. So, you know, he comes back, and most guys, you know, you very gingerly take their leg brace on, and you just see if they could get any bend in their knee. You know, if you could get 20, 30 degrees of knee flexion when that, you know, they take the brace off, you're thrilled. And he just takes his knee and sits on the end of the table and just bends it right to 90 degrees. And I'm just like, whoa, you know what? That was my first, you gotta be
was
kidding
it
me moment. So it was, yeah, I mean a little bit, okay. But I mean, I swear if you take a scalpel and run it across his chest, I'm not sure if he's going to bleed. I mean, he just is, he's just a different guy. And, you know, it was, for me, it was so fun, but also so trepidatious because like you said, there's a point when you're doing ACL rehab where the ACL ligament is literally weaker than it was before. It was the new ligament was weaker because it has to regenerate and develop its strength and develop all its collagen. And there's like a 6 week period where it's really dangerous. If you do something wrong, you're going to tear that repair. And man, talk about some stressful nights, just protecting him from himself, because there was nothing he thought. And I'm just going to tell one story about him again. I know we're on limited time here, but we were at OTA.
Take your time.
The off-season program was starting, and I had Adrian. We were at the indoor facility at Winter Park. I had Adrian off to the side. I think he just had whipped his knee brace at me because he hated wearing it. He always would take it off and throw it at me. I'm not wearing this stupid thing. Yeah, put it on. You're not doing anything. We'd fight with each other. And, you know, anyway, he put it on, and the guys were running half gassers to finish their conditioning session, which is just stand on one side of the field, run across the field about 50 yards and come back. And he's like, let me just go do one. I think it was actually the first day of the program. Let me just go do one with those guys. I'm like, dude, no way. Like, there's no chance. Cause I know what you're going to do. You're going to try to be first and you're just not ready for that. He's like, I'll be fine. Just let me do one. And there was no telling him no. And there's a whole team of Minnesota Vikings that absolutely are looking at this guy in April that know they need him in September. And he's just starting, you know, he's a quarter way through his rehab, and off he goes to where the guys are. And what do you think happens? The whistle blows and Adrian just goes pew, pew, right across the field. He's the first one to finish. And it's just who he was. He just had a different it factor, and thankfully didn't hurt himself. And there's so many stories like that. One day it was 3 feet of snow outside. The team was practicing outside. He looked over to the left and he's just running through the snow. Like, he just would do crazy things. And, just a freak athlete, great guy to work with, just so genuine and thankful and appreciative and tough as nails. And it was a pleasure to be able to watch him play that season and win the MVP.
Rick, were you at all concerned during the rehab process that he was going to do something bad?
Well, if Shugs came up and if he listened to me and my brother on our medical advice, we probably wouldn't have anyone playing right now. We were a little old school with the medical treatments, would you say, Shug?
Yeah, we'd had some phone calls with Rick's brother, and he was. I got a lot of free advice, and just be thankful. I'm not sure we ever would have won a game if I listened to those guys.
All right, let's. I think that story's amazing. That one and the Theo story are great, but let's talk about quickly the evolution of sports science and data analysis, because that has changed a lot. It came into baseball back with Bill James and the Bill James method and all that came out of that, Billy Beane and the A's and Moneyball and so on and so forth. But football is a little more difficult to sort of variabilize, to make up a word, because there are 22 players doing different things on every single play. And it's not just 9 players on a baseball field. And because I know Rick has talked before on the podcast about how he just came to discover through the analytics department that social maturity was a measure, a surprising measure of how good an NFL a player might be as a wide receiver. Is that right, Rick?
Yes. Yeah, that was one of the telltale signs that the analytics find out.
Yeah. So what are you able to do medically that you've learned from sports science and data analytics, whether it's a body type that in college that maybe translates to the NFL that isn't well known, or injury history obviously probably plays some role. Are there things that have helped you focus what you're looking for when you're trying to find these players?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is really, to me, is common sense, is injury history.
Yeah.
If a guy was hurt 13 times in college, if you think he's going to walk in your door or never get hurt, you know, you're crazy, because injury history is really a telltale sign to me. But as far as sports science and the evolution, it's been incredible. And it's growing and growing as we sit here and talk. All the things that are tracked and measured, you know, every player now wears a sensor in their shirt that's under their shoulder pads or their jersey if they don't have pads on that day. And every training session is tracked. You could look at workload, speed, all these different things. The guys have sensors in their shoulder pads. They're in their cleats. They're in their helmets. I mean, there's not a lot that you aren't going to be able to find out about a player in today's NFL as far as sports science. But, you know, in my role as an athletic trainer, we use these for return to play. And, you know, we know, for instance, you know, what top speed does player X get in a game? What top speed does he normally get at a practice? What's his total distance covered on a Wednesday practice or during, you know, a week? And we would try to, you know, hit that number as we decided if this player was ready to return to play or return to practice. Try to get them as close as possible. So these tools are invaluable. You have things now that are force plates. You could jump on a force plate, see if a guy has an asymmetry right to left side. There's a device called a Nord board, which measures hamstring strength. And you can see if a guy has a big deficit, you know, they're more prone to have a hamstring injury. And the list goes on and on. So it's really, you know, 32 clubs, 32 ways to do business. But really, you have so many tools at your disposal. Sometimes it's paralysis by analysis. Sometimes you have to go back to the old school and use your eyes, because your eyes don't lie. But some of these things are really incredible. And, you know, now we are developing what's called the digital athlete, where all of these things will be migrated into one platform and really just incredible. And it's all about injury prevention, max performance, and making these guys be the best that they can be.
Do you think that has prevented injuries or lowered injuries?
Oh, without a doubt. Especially the teams that use it and use it the way it's meant to be used. Again, 32 different ways, and I can't speak to all the teams, but I can only speak to what we've done and what I've seen. But if teams are using it right, it will prevent injuries, because you can track, you know, when do your injuries occur? Do they occur after 90 minutes of practice? Do they occur when you do 3 padded practices, training camp, or whatever it might be? There are some real trends if you look at the science and you look at the numbers and compare your team to another to get benefit, to decrease lower extremity injuries, which are some of the most, you know, time consuming hamstring injuries and ACLs, some of the most largest time loss injuries we see in the league.
Would you say that the soft tissue injuries, most of them occur during training camp?
Not really. I mean, you see a big spike in soft tissue injuries once we get to after the period where, you know, you get acclimated. You do see a spike in soft tissue injuries, but they're all year long, you know, and they come for various reasons: dehydration, fatigue, asymmetries, you know, whatever it might be. So, you see a lot of them during training camp, but they do happen all year long.
So, Eric, when you're at the combine, what are you looking for? Actually, I guess sort of what's your role? Because Rick has mentioned to me in general terms about how all the doctors are in one room when the players come through during the medical part of the combine. I would imagine you're there too. Are you hands-on, like checking knees, shoulders? Or what are you looking for? What's your role, and how do you help in the evaluation process once you guys get back to the meetings, the draft meetings, back when you get in the building?
Yeah, so if I can really quick, Ryan, give a quick history of the combine. I know,
yeah,
Rick,
take your time.
Rick, as a scout and general manager, thinks that the combine was invented for him so that he can watch guys run 40s. Like, if a guy, you know, he's terrible in the 12 games he plays in college, but he runs a fast 40, so now we're going to pick him in the first round. That's how Rick did things. But, you know, it's crazy. the combine, you know, what does the combine stand for? It's the word combined. And in 1982, in 3 cities across our country, Tampa Bay, Philadelphia, I don't know the third one,
Arizona, I believe.
Okay, Arizona. Teams got together to do combined physical exams. Because prior to 1982, teams would just bring in players on their own and just do a physical so they had some medical knowledge. In 1983, it was still the same. In 1984, it went to New Orleans. 1985, it went to Arizona. 1986, back to New Orleans. And then in 1987, the combine became the combine as we know it in Indianapolis, where, again, the intention of this exercise was to gather medical information on draft prospects. Now, from that, this evolved to testing, 40s, bench press, all the other measurables that people like Rick love to look at when they are getting ready for a draft. In 2003, the NFL Network was established. And in 2004, in February, was the first time the combine was shown on TV. And from there, it has evolved into what we see made for TV, over 30 hours of coverage. You could see everything on the combine. So what you don't see is the most important part of the combine is what happens underneath the bowels of the stadium. And that is what I did for 25 years. And that was the combined physicals. So again, this has evolved as well through the years. Typically, in summary, what happens is an athlete comes in the night before, they sit down with a medical provider, they do a health history. Now, we as athletic trainers shared information and have medical histories on these players before we even see them in Indianapolis. So we know if a guy had an ACL or, you know, whatever, and we could have a game plan for that athlete before they even get there. So they do an intake report with an athletic trainer, healthcare provider, and just go through their medical history. Some guys maybe aren't forthright, and some guys may be instructed not to talk about any injuries. You know, you're on crutches right now. Is there something wrong with you? No, I'm fine. It's just like these crutches. You have to be a little bit of an investigator to get the information in any regard. Standard things, chest x-ray, and then, you know, like if, for instance, if a guy had an ACL, he's going to get an MRI of his knee. If he had a shoulder surgery, he's going to get an MRI of his shoulder. Standard x-rays, you know, things like that. Then the next day, the athlete will start with a medical exam. And when I say medical, it's, you know, ears, nose, and throat, a general med doc. So they, you know, go through, like as if, Ryan, you were getting a physical exam, that type of situation. I won't use Rick because his would take 4 days. So, you know, just use yours. But, you know, normal physical exam. And then they go into the orthopedic room. And this has evolved through the years. And obviously COVID threw a big wrench in it. This year was a little different than previous years. But just in general, from the way that it happens is player X, you know, walks into a room. He's grabbed by a random physician. It's not assigned. It's a whoever. You know, we would bring three orthopedic physicians, for instance. One sat with me at the table when the guy was presented, and the other two would do exams. And this guy would get examined by a physician. They would look at his MRI if it was in the system already, and in a side room out of the view of anyone. Then the player would come in a room, and there's six different rooms at the combine, each with five or six teams in each room. And it's the same teams every year. It's not by division. I have no idea how it is established. It's been like that forever. When I was with the Vikings, for instance, it was the Patriots, the Browns, the Vikings, the Rams.
Baltimore.
I think the Ravens. Yeah, yep. The Ravens. So that was the room I was in. And the player would get presented. You know, this is player X from, you know, University of Minnesota. He has a medical history of right shoulder subluxation. His MRI today shows no injuries and blah, 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 blah. And you go through it and they're presented. They used to do that six times. So they would get six different exams by six different orthopedic surgeons and presented separately in the six different rooms. So sometimes something would be missed by one room, picked up by another, and this orders an MRI. But now this past season, they were only examined one time and presented. That same physician would present them to each room. So they were only examined one time, just to cut back a little bit on the, you know, having the guy to get poked and prodded so much, because obviously that's a little much. So that's the premise. But, you know, really, Ryan, that's just the beginning. You get that information, you put it in the computer, you come back home, and then a couple weeks later, you get all the reports, you get all their lab work, you get their eye exam, you get all their x-ray reports, you get their MRIs. And now it was weeks and weeks and weeks of work establishing a medical grade, and every team does it differently for these players. And then we would, you know, sit in, I did not, some athletic trainers and doctors sit in the draft meetings and go over each player as the scouts talk about them. Our method was that I had one meeting at the end, and it was several hours, and we'd go through the whole board and talk about all the players. And then Rick and I would separately go over the sideboard, just, you know, him and I, usually one or two of my coworkers. So it was a really interesting process. I really enjoyed it. I did share grades with people that I trusted in the business. And when I say that, other athletic trainers, we would, you know, spread the work, you know, you call on this guy, I'll call on that guy. And that goes as far as, you know, our scouts were instructed to tell me about any injuries at any pro days, because that was critical. And also, how did the guy do at his pro day? Because, you know, maybe he didn't work at the combine because he had an ankle, and now he works at his pro day. You know, did he run his 40 as he should? And on and on and on up into the draft. And you know, once Rick asked me about a guy 7 or 8 times, I knew that's who we were picking.
Hey, Rick.
Yeah, I got one more thing. Yeah. Without naming names, what is probably the most bizarre thing that you've seen come through there in your 25 years, if you can recall anything?
You know, go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say, feel free to name names if you want to call somebody out too. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I won't name names. I mean, just a couple. I mean, listen, we've diagnosed with guys with cancer, with leukemia. There's been lives saved at the combine. You know, bizarre things, you know, gunshot wounds, bullets still in people's bodies and things like that. I don't think of anything like crazily bizarre. I'm trying to think right now. Nothing crazy comes to mind. It's the bad stuff that comes to mind. But, you know, the other thing just of interest is, I on draft day, it was always interesting because there really, for me, there was really no stress on draft day because all the work was done. You know, the guys that were medical red dots were, you know, Rick always called me the dream killer. Anytime I walked in the room and all the scouts were in there, they'd say, oh, here comes the dream killer, you know. And I think Coach Zimmer called me Dr. Death. I had a lot of nicknames in that time. I don't know what they called me when I wasn't in there, but I don't care. But that said, like, I remember a player, again, without mentioning names, that was a highly touted player that a lot of people in our draft room really liked, this player. And he was first round talent and they liked him, but he was really injured. And in our medical staff's opinion, he wasn't worth a first round risk, and we didn't take him.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Dan Orlovsky, are you still a Jaden Daniels is the best quarterback available in the draft guy?
I think the three things that make it stand out for me are, number one, I think his ball placement versus man coverage is the best in the draft. Every quarterback in the NFL is accurate. He's got the best on tape. Number two, most transferable stuff to the NFL. And then I think the third thing is pocket peace.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.
From producers Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, explore how art and music sustained hope during the siege of Sarajevo, thanks in part to humanitarians and the band U2. Kiss the Future, new documentary now streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus. Go to Paramount Plus to try it free. Terms apply.
Nor did anyone else, which verified our thinking. Mm-hmm. And then comes Friday, which is the second and third round. And we didn't take them. We talked about it ad nauseum. Rick likes to repeat himself. I don't know if you know that. We talked about him at nauseam, and we didn't take him. And we didn't take him in the third round, nor did anyone else. And now you come to Saturday, and I get the 9-1 call from Rick. Are you in the building yet? Like, Rick, it's 6:30. It's Saturday. We won't start till 11. Like, no, I'll be there at 10. Now you have to decide. You're in the fourth round. You have to decide risk versus reward with some of these guys. And we ultimately didn't pick this player. He may or may not still play in the league. And I will happily say he's not a perennial Pro Bowler. So, you know, he was a good player. And my biggest fear was his rookie year that he'd have a touchdown against us, whether it was a offensive or defensive touchdown, I'm not going to say. But he didn't. But I heard about it. You know, it's really interesting process. I really enjoyed the combine and the draft and all that.
It's amazing. And Ryan, we hit to sit here and do all these mocks, and I get to criticize your mocks, but I do respect all the hard work that you put into
them. They make them say that, Eric, which is nice.
But what people don't realize is if guys are falling in a draft or guys that are okay, he was mocked in the second round, yet this guy continues to fall. A lot of times it might not be what you saw on tape. It might be what Shug just described. It was a medical flunk or a fail that we wouldn't want to bring into our organization, or something from a character standpoint that we dug up. But the public will never know that. And the public will never know the information that the team knows. So when you do see guys slide in the draft, a lot of it will have to do not with what his ability is and what you evaluated on tape, as much as all these medicals and background checks and everything we do that will slide guys. But I do remember, I'd like to put Shug's on the spot. So if we take this guy, Shug, how long is his career going to last?
I'd get that a lot. And it was, you know, what I learned was, Ryan, is just consistency. If you're just consistent, which I tried to be through the 16 years with the team, Docs, just be consistent, and you're going to hit most of the time. You're not always going to hit, but just be consistent. And you know, two other quick things just that are on my brain is, you know, you'll see the same teams take the red dot guys. And I won't mention those teams, but we did see trends of, you know, those teams just take risks. Some teams like to take risks more than others, whether it's character or medical. And you know, it's just really interesting. And the other thing is just, you know, Rick's ability to most impressive thing to me was certainly not Rick's draft picks, but was the ability that
and this Rick, will be the last time he'll be on the show.
was on, really Rick. Just that no the knowledge of the room, the knowledge of Rick and his staff of when a team is getting ready to pick who they're going to pick, or at least what position they're going to pick. And just the knowledge before the draft that these guys had was just amazing to me. Their ability to know and predict what other teams were going to do was really remarkable, and just goes to the credit of everyone that's in that room that does that job. It's this is not a dartboard where you throw darts and just hope. I mean, it's pretty interesting. And I'm sure most teams are like that, but really impressive the work that all these scouts and people do throughout the league.
And I'll tell you a quick story, Ryan, is that when analytics took all what we called red dotted medical people, which means they flunked our physical, no matter if they were first round talent and it's in the seventh round, we're not going to grab them. Or if they were a red dot character, that was something that we also had a lot of discussion on. But if they had the combination of both, red dot medical and red dot character, and there were probably close to 50 to 60 of those guys that had the daily double, not one of those guys ever made it in the NFL, regardless of when they were drafted. And so what Shug was talking about too, medical is a little bit subjective. You could look at the MRIs, you can look at the medical history, you can look at the guy's, you know, toenails, if they're growing crooked or not, but their time on the chopping block up there to give their opinion as well. And it's not 100% either, but it's pretty good sure that if they say that he's not going to be able to play, or as is, you take him in the first round and you are signed a 5-year contract, he may not see 3 years of that. And pretty much that was dead on. And anytime that I knew making those decisions, if Shug and his medical staff, because I trusted them and they were the best in the business, and it proved through the analytics as well, we never overruled, or I never overruled what Shug said.
Oh, really? I was going to ask you about that.
I would never overrule a medical. I don't think Shug ever in our time together did I ever overrule you.
No, we'd have some good discussions. But there was never, you know, we would have some repetitive discussions to make sure. But he never did. No, we never took a red dot medical guy. There never was a trying to talk me in. Well, there probably was a few times trying to talk me into it. But we steadfast on that. And, you know, that's appreciated. That's respect to the doctors and to the process.
Look at you, Rick. I like that. I was going to ask you exactly that, because you and Eric out of work have some, you have competitive juices that get the best of both of you. And I was wondering if you ever got after Eric and he had to say, listen, we're not doing this no matter how bad you want to do it.
No, because it never got contentious. We could have, and I'll ask 100 times just because I'm a rep guy that needs 100 times to hear it just to make sure so it gets ingrained in my skull. So
right.
When it was draft day and Shugs was in there, and it was a medical red dot, there was no discussions.
Okay.
It was all done. The draft board was final, and we were just going to go. But once we made all those decisions, it was not. And even if it was a guy that we didn't flunk, but we had concerns with, we would take him a round or two later just because of those medical concerns, because it was less financial risk if we did lose him. But I just give you one example of we brought a player into the Minnesota Vikings training facility, and Shug and his staff found out the player, and I won't name the player, had leukemia.
Mm.
The kid didn't even know he had it, probably saved his life.
Right.
So there is so much that go on behind the scenes that the public does not see. And in that case, and that person went on to be very successful in his career that he's doing right now. But they might have probably saved his life because he had no idea that he had leukemia.
No, that's amazing. And by the way, we said 30 minutes. We're going to keep Eric the whole time just because. And here's a comment from the chat, the live chat here. Matt Weber asks, Eric, what's your overreaching view on the term, quote unquote, injury prone? It seems nowadays it's just a broad stroke that you give a player that had a somewhat serious injury in the last year. Is there such a thing as injury prone? What does it mean to you in the medical field?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. I remember first guy comes to mind is Kyle Rudolph. You know, they said he was injury prone. He got hurt a couple of times, and then he played years and years without any injuries. Is it such a thing? You know, that there are certain guys that are maybe more prone to getting injured, and I'd see those guys as what I call the track athletes, the speed guys. And when they're injury prone, it's muscle injuries. But you know, in nowadays, there are so many. Again, so many things with sports science, so many recovery tools, so many things you could do with your diet that really no one should be injury prone anymore. And if they are injury prone, they're probably not going to make it to this level. So I don't use that term. I don't think it's a thing. I think it could be fixed. Maybe guys have bad luck. You know, you got an offensive right. lineman that's engaged with the defensive lineman and another guy up on him and breaks his ankle. Is he injury prone or is he just unlucky? He's probably unlucky. So that's, I'm not going to buy the term injury prone.
But I think you would agree that if you have a hamstring injury, you might be predisposed to getting hamstring injuries as opposed to someone who doesn't, or is that not a thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe, but again, it should be fixable. You should be able to, if you have a good staff, you should be able to identify why, you know, the okay. why is this guy getting hamstring strains? Does he have a deficit? Does he have something with his diet or something like that that you could hopefully fix? And so that's a one or two time deal. So,
okay. Cause I've had hamstring issues, Rick, and I didn't know if it was just me, my diet, or the fact that I'm probably not going to be a professional athlete.
All three combined and plus some yeah. that we didn't even mention on the air.
Yeah. I would check the, all the above box. Yeah.
Eric, you know, Rick better than anyone. And he and I've spent probably close to 2 months together now. So I've learned a lot about Rick. Do you know what his 40 time was coming out of Southern Illinois?
I think it was a 7.25. I think.
He's a 2.5.
Something like that.
No, that was my brother. You're getting us confused. I was a good straight line athlete.
You want to tell him, Rick, or should we keep him?
I have so many stories from the tennis court, the basketball court, the golf court. I mean, he has anger management issues when it comes to competition. So it is what it is.
Except pool. I thought he might get angry at the pool table, but he just went to bed. It was 9:30. It was time to go. He wasn't going to.
9:30. I got to get to bed. I got to carry the show tomorrow at the pro day of Florida. It just never ends.
I will say, like, and you touched on this, Eric, like Rick doesn't like it when you say nice things about him, but he has been incredibly gracious to me over our time together. He has done so much at the pro days, at every single pro day, Ohio State, Alabama, Kentucky, Florida, got us into the team room.
And we're at the 1 hour mark, and that's the end of the podcast today. 25 days until the NFL draft. And Ryan, I appreciate all the hard work you put into this and all your mock drafts and your evaluations. It's incredible to sit there and watch you work.
You're getting better at this. So, Eric, is there anything else that you want to tell us about before we get out of here? Because clearly Rick's getting uncomfortable with the positive talk.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the time. I hope that, you know, someone that listened can take something out of this. And, you know, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. been a pleasure to be part of the NFL for 25 years and hopefully a few more here soon.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a pleasure to have you on to talk with us, and hopefully we can do it again before you move on to your next gig, because once that happens, it'll be, mom will be the word, I'm sure. But Rick wanted to have you on. I wanted to have you on. It was great to meet you.
He didn't really want to have you on. He goes, why does an athletic trainer come on? What do we want to get out of it?
I knew the moment that I met Eric at the combine that I wanted to talk more with him because of the stories he has about you and the shared experiences.
Thank God Pete's not on this podcast or they'd still be going.
Can we do one with Pete and we'll just mute Rick and we can just tell stories about Rick? That'd be great.
Yes. That will be the next podcast, 100%. Because once you meet Pete, you don't forget Pete Briscoe.
Yeah.
Eric, seriously, thank you so much. This was incredibly informative. I loved all the stories. Love hearing you talk about your time with Rick. And Rick, do you want to say anything nice to Eric before we go?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
That sounds about right.
Appreciate it.
So listen, I'm glad we had Eric for the whole hour. So we didn't talk about the mailbag. We'll do that in a future episode. We'll do the Just Good Football Players in a future episode. So Rick, we don't have to worry about that. Our guy Billy is going to stick in the commercials that we didn't get to because we talked the whole time. But thanks everyone for watching and for listening. On Wednesday, we might have a couple more guests to talk to you, Rick. I didn't tell you about that, so that'll be something to look forward to. We're going to talk.
Great. I don't have to talk. I just sit here and listen the whole time.
You sit there and you're eye candy, so that's something you can work on. Yeah. And I think we're talking wide receivers and offensive linemen. Then we'll do a mock draft on Thursday, so we'll come back for those shows. In the meantime, thank you, Eric. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Billy, for producing, and we'll see you guys on Wednesday.
Baseball season is in full swing, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Stample, every weekday as we recap every player from every game. We'll talk waiver wire ads, drops, players to trade for, prospects who could make an impact, and everything in between. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.